Stone Symposium. My name is Cindy Daly, and I'll be introducing the speakers this morning. I want to remind you that admission to these sessions is by name tag or ticket only. If you haven't registered, you can do that out in the lobby. This morning, our speaker will be Richard Willett, and I just want to give you a little bit of background information on him. He is a native of Sacramento, California, and I asked him how he ended up in Utah, and he said he came for love, but the love didn't last, and he stayed anyway. His topic today is authority in ecclesiology and primitive Christianity and Mormonism. And I asked him how he became interested in that particular topic, and he said he's had a long interest in biblical studies and, as a matter of fact, had planned to pursue that. But as he opted to go with a history degree in order to broaden his horizons a little bit. So at this point, he's a student at the University of Utah, and he'll be receiving his history degree in June of 1991. He is a discussion leader of one of the liberal ed courses taught at the University of Utah called the American Race Dilemma. And this Sunday, he'll be going to Atlanta to research a paper on the last 3 years of Martin Luther King's life. He's particularly interested in his speeches and the things that he said in those particular years when he came out against not only racism, but poverty, economic inequality, and the Vietnam War. And he received a grant from the Ethnic Studies at the University of Utah to do this research on Martin Luther King. If you've read the abstract in the program, you'll know that he's going to be looking at the authority and the organization of the primitive church and how it compares to Mormonism and see just exactly what Mormonism did restore of that primitive church. After Richard is through, Laurie Lavity will make some comments on the paper. Laurie is a PhD candidate from the University of Chicago, and she'll be getting her doctoral degree in ancient culture. She's working currently on her dissertation, which is a comparison of the ancient priesthoods in the Mediterranean. She's from Logan, and she's living there now while she writes her dissertation because it's a little bit cheaper than living in Chicago. Laurie has extensive knowledge of ancient languages, Greek, Hebrew, Latin, Akkadian, and a little bit of French. And it was a real pleasure for me to see her name on the program when I arrived here yesterday because I knew her back in Chicago, and this is the first time we've seen each other in about 4 years. We'll go until 9:30, and after the speakers are done, if you have any questions, they'll be glad to answer any of your questions. Richard?
I took a German class this quarter, summer quarter, and I know a little Spanish from my mission, so that's all the languages I know. so I'm going to be relying on secondary sources primarily throughout this paper. The title of my paper is Authority in Ecclesiology in Primitive Christianity and Mormonism. From its very inception, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has claimed to be a restoration of primitive Christianity. But this raises questions, however, as to what exactly was restored. Among the most common responses by Latter-day Saints would probably be the following. 1, that God's plan of salvation was restored. 2, the priesthood authority necessary to do God's work. And 3, an organization to be the channel for implementing these unto the world's people. Jan Shipps has argued recently that the distinction between Mormonism and other 19th century primitive gospel movements was in Mormonism's direct literal connection with the Old Testament stories of Israel. It had much more influence from the Old Testament than other groups. While aware of the similarities between Mormonism and ancient Israel, this paper will restrict itself to a comparison of primitive Christianity, what I'm defining as like anything before the year 100 AD, and Mormonism. And I'll be discussing the latter 2 points mentioned above, the restoration of priesthood and organization. Now, I'm going to assume that most of you are more familiar with Mormonism, so I'm going to spend more time talking about the scholarly view of early Christianity. Within the past two decades, biblical scholars have developed a nuanced view of how Jesus of Nazareth organized the Christian church. Now, according to Webster's Third International Dictionary, the word nuance means a shade of difference, minute variation, subtle distinction. Okay, so just slight changes here and there. The long-held view that Jesus ordained 12 apostles who in turn established congregations, each with an ordained leader, is rejected today. In fact, that Jesus even intended to have a church continue in his name is doubtful. Ernst Cassaman has written the following, quote, "Jesus certainly did not create a church in our sense of the word, embracing both Jews and Gentiles. According to the conviction of many New Testament scholars, he did not even express any desire that such a church should exist. The rule of God which he proclaimed is not adorned in any later ecclesiastical dress." Roman Catholic scholars since the Vatican II Council of the early 60s have been at the forefront of research into ecclesiastical and priesthood origins. Priest and scholar Raymond E. Brown, who represents a centrist position between the conservative and liberal wings of biblical scholarship, has written extensively concerning the founding of the church. I'm going to read a large quote here, and it's pretty important that you catch the message. Okay, quote, "In his lifetime, Jesus called around him a community of disciples as a renewed Israel. Fortified by Jesus' victory over death and the resurrection, and by the gift of the Spirit, these disciples, in imitation of Jesus' own baptism, made the formal step of requiring a visible sign for adherence to Jesus. The community, which now began to be more and more a group distinct within Judaism, separate, soon adopted the term church. The Semitic equivalent of this term, which described Israel in the desert, and so it wasn't necessarily foreign to Jesus' thought patterns, the idea of a separate community being in the desert. When understood with nuance, then, the proposition that Christ founded the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church is not necessarily foreign to modern exegesis of the New Testament. A negative description, saying that Jesus didn't organize any church, presupposes an oversimplified understanding of church origins. What he's saying is that some scholars look for explicit signs on the part of Jesus as to our beginning a church, like laying on the hands of people and stuff like that. And it's not there in the New Testament. And so if you're just looking for those, then you're going to say he didn't organize a church. But according to Raymond E. Brown and many Roman Catholic scholars, the actions of Jesus implied the founding of a church. And so what Brown is positing is an implicit intention on Jesus' part to found a church. This position, which is a far cry from the traditional view of a church, based upon a priesthood succession traceable back to Jesus through the laying on of hands, is held by most Roman Catholic scholars today, a group which seemingly would have more threatened by this position than Protestants would. Did Jesus establish a priesthood authority? Again, this is a question that demands a nuanced answer. Centrist Catholic scholars would see the institution of the priesthood implied in Jesus' words at the Last Supper, "Do this in commemoration of me." Besides that incident, however, as Brown notes, quote, "There is no evidence in the language of Jesus that he thought about a priesthood replacing the Jewish priesthood in the temple." Whatever the intention of Jesus at the Last Supper, the authority that was possibly implied was only recognized by Christians after decades of reflecting upon its meaning. Thus, the Jesus that emerges from contemporary biblical scholarship was relatively unconcerned with organization, neither among his followers while alive nor for his followers who would continue on after his death. This is understandable if it's realized that Jesus did not intend to found a sect or a church separate from Judaism. His message of the kingdom of God was a call to renew Israel, which already had worship, priesthood, and temple. Thus, he did not need to establish a rival religion. But if he did establish an ecclesia or a priesthood hierarchy in a nuanced, implicit manner, he did so in an unclear manner that would take years for his disciples to comprehend. Now, I'm going to be going through the history of early Christian communities, and I just want to say that it's virtually impossible to create a chronological history of the early Christian communities as if they developed in a nice set pattern that we can clearly recognize. But for the sake of the paper, I'm going to have to oversimplify to some degree. Immediately after the resurrection of Jesus, virtually all of his followers were Palestinian Jews centered around Jerusalem who still believed in the necessity of the law of Moses and who attended the temple frequently. Hans Conzelman has written, quote, "For them, their faith is not a new religion, which leads them away from the Jewish religion, but the confirmation of the promise to Israel," end quote. Only their belief that something, it's kind of vague, but they interpreted it in very different ways. Only their belief that something of a salvific nature had and was taking place through Jesus of Nazareth, as well as their expectation of the imminent end of time, marked them as different from other Jews. They weren't perceived as a threat to Judaism, but simply as a tiny, eccentric group. At first, the 12 were probably the focal point of the community, since they had been chosen by Jesus as symbolizing the restoration of Israel. The Palestinian Jewish Christians saw themselves as the renewal of Judaism. Now, leadership underwent a number of transformations within the first generation in the Palestinian church. Chapter 6 and 15 of Acts, chapter 15 happening in the year 49 AD, depict the 12 as an advisory council when major decisions came up. Yet, in the same general period, the 12, as a group, were diminishing in their role as supervisors of the local Jerusalem Christians. Individual members of the 12, such as Peter, James, and John, ascended to a leadership role in the Jerusalem community. Nevertheless, by the year 45, James had been killed, and Peter and John's local role was fading. Another James, the brother of Jesus, replaced them as head of the Jerusalem community and remained in this position until the year 62 AD. Under his leadership, the Jerusalem Christians adopted the system of government used by the local synagogues, a body of elders. Palestinian Jewish Christianity had a charismatic form of government in the early years, up to around the late 40s. And this is the reason why there is an unsettled question of leadership at this time, as I've already mentioned. Spiritual manifestations were used as evidence for authority, and decisions were often made without correlating them with others. There was just a lot of spontaneity and charisma going on. The synagogue form adopted by James transformed this pattern, however, and it was this latter type of administrative government which lasted until the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in 70 AD and the accompanying scattering of the Jewish Christians out of the city. Now, quite contrary to the view of the Christian past that the early church was united and divisions crept in only after the apostles died, is an apparent split within the very first Christian community. Acts chapter 6 mentions two groups, the Hebrews and the Hellenists, involved in a dispute over the neglect of the Hellenist widows. Scholars reviewing the section have concluded that the dispute was much more serious than it would appear at first glance. The Hellenists were Jews who had moved to Jerusalem after living in Hellenized cities. They were Jews of the diaspora. They had adopted Greek customs and language, and they no longer believed that God necessarily dwelt in the Jewish temple. Although Hellenists did not flat out reject the Mosaic law, their indifference to it alarmed the Hebrews in the Jerusalem church, and the Hebrews including the 12. And this brought down enough persecution from non-Christian Jews within Jerusalem to eventually drive them out of the city. By and large, the Jews, the Christians in Jerusalem, who still adhered to the law of Moses and went to the temple, didn't receive much persecution. It was the ones who attacked the temple, like Stephen, that were in trouble. Once these Hellenists reached Antioch, they became the first to convert Gentiles into the church. Thus it was not Peter, Paul, or the 12 who began the Gentile mission. These converts felt no obligation to observe the Mosaic law. As the New Jerome Biblical Commentary points out, quote, "The widespread mission resulted from unforeseen circumstances rather than from a blueprint plan of going to the whole world." While still in Jerusalem, the leadership of the Hellenists consisted of the seven men named in Acts chapter 6. Conzelman has commented on their role, quote, "It is clear that the seven are the leading body of a special group in the community They do not stand beneath the 12, but alongside them. End quote. Whereas Jerusalem would develop an authority structure patterned after the synagogue, Hellenistic Christianity continued basing authority upon a more charismatic foundation. At Antioch, for example, prophets and teachers provided the leadership, not because they were appointed to such offices, but because this is how the Spirit moved them. Acts indicates that they often moved on to other towns to share their message, and they weren't restricted to any one city. Despite the difference between the Hellenists and the Hebrews and the respective converts, they never broke what's called koinonia, which means communion with each other. They didn't excommunicate each other. They recognized they had differences, but they still kept in contact with each other and didn't feel like they were unorthodox or, you know, needed to be thrown out. The Hellenistic Jewish mission always considered Jerusalem to be the mother church because the resurrection occurred there. Over time, the Christian mission to the Jews continually failed, and the mission to Gentiles and Hellenized Jews reaped many converts to the astonishment of everyone. As a result, within a decade of the crucifixion of Jesus, the village culture of Palestine had been left behind. It didn't work there. And the Greco-Roman city became the dominant environment of the Christian movement. This was a surprise. After all, Jesus pretty much confined his mission to Jews. This is significant because urban centers were the focus of a Greek culture which would have a profound impact upon Christianity. Within this environment, the Mosaic Law increasingly lost its importance for the majority of Christians. Now, the Jerusalem Council in the year 49 was a watershed event in the development of Christianity. In response to the complaints of some Judaizing Christians that Gentile converts in Antioch were not receiving circumcision, the apostles and elders of the council decided that circumcision was unnecessary for conversion to Christianity. The implications of this was that Christianity wasn't just going to remain a sect within Judaism, that it would become a new religion. For Paul, this signified approval for his mission to Gentiles and Hellenized Jews, and he responded by enjoying the most productive years of his leadership. Charisma was the type of leadership exercise in the branches of Christianity that Paul established. He expected God's Spirit to compel whosoever was necessary to act if a decision needed to be made. In other words, everyone, to some degree, exercised leadership. Yet Paul also recognized that some have more regular ministries than most. As an apostle, he had the highest authority in the churches he personally founded, but he wasn't recognized outside of his own sphere of influence, which is a subtlety he expected in turn from other Christian leaders. You know, I've got my turf, you've got yours, let's keep it that way. Accordingly, as Wayne Meeks has pointed out, quote, the original apostles of Jerusalem seem to have had little or no direct authority as far as the Pauline churches were concerned. On the local level, Pauline churches usually had charismatic prophets and teachers. In addition, it is plausible that Paul arranged for local leadership to act in his stead when he left some areas, although a uniform pattern can't be detected. Indeed, Philippians' mention of bishops and deacons suggests that the process of formalizing offices was already beginning in the year 55 AD, although positions weren't emphasized nor completely institutionalized until the very end of the century. The community by and for whom the Gospel of John was written, which scholars call the Johannine community, presents a striking departure from the blueprint ecclesiology which is often supposed to be in the New Testament. Tracing its origins back to a group similar in outlook to the Hellenists of Acts 6, or perhaps directly to that group, the Johannine community developed a high pre-existent Christology, which led to being thrown out of the Jewish synagogues. Christology basically means, what is your view of Jesus? How divine and how human is he? A high Christology means that one emphasizes the divine aspects of Jesus, like the Gospel of John. A low Christology, like the Gospel of Mark, would emphasize more human qualities of Jesus. The Johannine community saw Jesus as being God in a pre-existent state. This got them kicked out of the synagogues. And so that's why in John you get such virulent language against the Jews. They based their authority upon two things. the beloved disciple and the paraclete, which is the Holy Spirit. The Gospel of John depicts the beloved disciple as being the only male follower to truly comprehend Jesus and as the one whom Jesus particularly loved. The memory of the beloved disciple's relationship to Jesus provided legitimacy for the high Christology of this community. A notion of offices, charismatic or otherwise, is absent from the Gospel of John. In fact, the word apostle is not used once in the writings of John. The community literally believed the words of chapter 14, verse 26. The paraclete, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything. The guidance of the Spirit was emphasized in reaction to the growing institutionalization process of other Christian groups. The believer's personal relationship with God, who's represented by the beloved disciple in the Gospel of John, was deemed more important than holding a leadership position, which is represented by Peter in the Gospel of John. And Peter is absent-minded, can't quite understand Jesus. He kind of looks like a fool at times in the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John emphasizes this personal relationship with God that takes precedent over any leadership position one can hold. Now, after the death in the 60s of the three primary figures in early Christianity, Peter, Paul, and James, local churches struggled to cope with the leadership vacuum and to retain sound doctrine. Since, as Brown noted, quote, the New Testament does not show the 12 laying hands on bishops, either as successors or as auxiliaries in administering sacraments. It is likely that leadership evolved as the circumstances dictated. In addition, the delay of the parousia, the second coming, made it clear that the church had to survive in the world. Early Christians believed the second coming would come pretty quickly, and as time went on, they realized that this wasn't happening, so they had to cope with that. So local churches responded by creating authority structures, the most common of which by the 80s and 90s were a collective group of leaders at local levels holding the interchangeable titles of presbyters, bishops. This particular type of leadership may have been patterned after the elders and deacons of Pharisaic Judaism. Deacons and youngers also existed, although it's unclear how they differed from the presbyteri. Although female deacons and an official class of widows existed, they had no authority over men. By the turn of the century, a single bishop had come to outrank the presbyters, a pattern that became the dominant one in what Ignatius, around the year 110, termed the Church Catholic. So here in early Christianity, we see lots of different who had different emphases. They had different leadership patterns. There was not a centralization. But yet, they never excommunicated each other. They kept in contact and communion with others. But they disagreed on some very important issues. And as we can see, the New Testament has trajectories within it that led to early Catholicism. In the early period, you have this charismatic form of leadership. And then by the late writings in the New Testament, like the pastoral epistles of Paul, you get bishops and teachers, and you get more of a hierarchical leadership priesthood idea. And this would develop in the second century into the Catholic Church. Okay, now I'm going to talk about Mormonism. In light of the history of primitive Christianity as seen by modern biblical scholars, what can be said for Mormonism's claim to have restored God's priesthood and organization? Obviously, the scholars can be ignored, and perhaps for some valid reasons. Attempting to reconstruct years of history from only a handful of documents is admittedly a difficult and perhaps futile task. Others may reject biblical scholarship because its conclusions are tentative and disputable. These positions have a point. However, sooner or later, Mormonism, like all other religions, will have to deal with the scholars' findings. Although it is a fallible science, biblical scholarship that doesn't absolve a church from using the best research possible. Taking biblical scholarship seriously, let's examine the issues at hand, beginning with the specific similarities and differences between the two movements. Organization in primitive Christianity developed in a slow and haphazard manner compared to Mormonism, which had its basic authority structure working within Joseph Smith's lifetime. In this regard, four observations can be made. First, Mormonism was more centralized than post-resurrection Christianity. Although Peter was recognized by the latter third of the first century as the dominant disciple figure who, quote, did more than any other to hold together the diversity of first century Christianity, this is James Dunn speaking, end quote, Peter's was a more de facto leadership, whereas Joseph Smith's was de jure virtually from the outset. In other words, by the time the New Testament documents were written, it was recognized that this Peter did more than any other person to bridge the gap between these different Christian communities. And so the New Testament writings reflect this, not because he was appointed to this position necessarily, but because that's what he did. Whereas Joseph Smith, in the Book of Commandments, labels him and says that this person is the leader. Indeed, early Christianity had various authority figures besides Peter, who did not see themselves as a subordinate to Peter, but as equals, but with different spheres of influence. Second, both movements developed priesthood authority structures as the need arose, and then legitimized such changes by retroactively inserting the story of their origins back into the telling of the past. This process is most clear in Mormonism. Initially, believers said that the church simply had authority from God, which they had received in a metaphysical fashion similar to the Book of Mormon and biblical accounts of prophetic callings. You don't have an emphasis on laying on of hands or of a legalistic lineal priesthood. It was more of a metaphysical thing where God has called me. Okay, and you get that in the Book of Mormon and in the Bible and in among early Mormonism. It was a feeling, you know. There was no mention of the term priesthood until 1831, when the high priesthood, that's what it was called, was introduced. This was identified as the Melchizedek priesthood 1 year later. An emphasis upon the legal aspects of authority, tracing one's priesthood through a lineal succession of the laying on of hands, did not begin until September 1832, approximately the same time Joseph Smith first mentioned having been ordained to the holy priesthood by an angel at some unspecified time. So the high priesthood later became known as Melchizedek, the holy priesthood later became known as the Aaronic priesthood. This angel was not identified as John the Baptist until 1835. The same year, Joseph Smith said he had received the Melchizedek priesthood under the hands of Peter, James, and John some 6 years earlier. The non-existence of any confirming evidence contemporary to the angelic ordinations, the question of why Smith and Cowdery kept such information from public knowledge, and the erratic manner in which these developments took place has led some to call into question whether such angelic ordinations actually took place, or whether this was a means for Smith to fight off the many challenges to his authority. But whatever the case may be, it is the LDS equivalent of a process that we see existent also in the New Testament. Reading present-day developments and theologies back into the past, where they didn't necessarily, but may have, according to one's faith, they didn't necessarily occur or exist. That Christianity, like Mormonism, went from a charismatic emphasis of authority from God to a legalistic emphasis of priesthood succession is obvious. However, the process, which took less than a decade in the LDS Church to take place, required more than a century in Christianity. The idea of a special Christian priesthood did not emerge until the early second century. And just as Joseph Smith strengthened his authority by maintaining ordination to divine personages, second century Christian leaders claimed to possess an authority that was traceable back to Jesus. Whether or not Joseph Smith was ordained by angels or whether or not Jesus began a church depends on one's faith. There really is no evidence for or against it that proves anything conclusively. But what I'm saying is that they're saying that this happened had the effect of strengthening their authority. The fact that it wasn't just a medical physical calling that Joseph Smith received, but that angels actually put their hands on his head strengthened his authority. And second century Christian leaders who said, as Clement does, in around the year 90, he stated that the gospel was given from God to Christ, to the apostles, who appointed bishops and deacons with the power to appoint others. So this way their authority was strengthened. But whether that happened or not is a matter of faith. As we can see, Christianity and Mormonism underwent a similar process of understanding authority. Ironically, the orthodox interpretation of the sacred past that would emerge in both movements were stories that would have been somewhat unfamiliar to the original communities. What I'm saying is that if we taught the missionary discussions to a Mormon in 1834, they wouldn't recognize the ordination of Peter, James, and John and stuff, even though it happened 4 years earlier, because that story just wasn't told at that time. And the same thing in early Christianity. I'm not saying that these things didn't happen. Again, I want to say that this is a matter of faith. The reasons why people understood these developments later on are unknown, or you could say that they were God working in the Spirit to reveal more, line upon line, precept upon precept, to his people. The final comparisons I wish to make concern specific offices. The activities of 1842 Mormon apostles appear similar to the missionary apostles, such as Paul, in early Christianity. The general church-wide authority gained in 1842 by Mormonism's apostles find its closest parallel in the decision-making of the Jerusalem 12 in Acts chapters 6 and 15. However, as far as we know, Christianity's 12 did not travel extensively like those in Mormonism have. In fact, for only two members of Jerusalem's 12 is there any evidence of a far-reaching ministry. Nor did the 12 ever preside over a local church. They were there in Jerusalem, and their role was an eschatological symbolic one, that Jesus came to renew Israel, the 12 tribes, and he appointed 12 men to symbolize this. So they were, elder statesmen. and when certain things came up, they were consulted. But they weren't known as, the authorities that have to be consulted whenever decisions are made throughout the whole church. They never presided over a local church, something which would be comparable to a 19th century LDS apostle serving as a mission president. Lastly, Mormonism's local leadership, bishops, stake presidents, elders, etc., takes after the institutionalized offices born primarily in the post-60s primitive church. These offices didn't exist in the apostolic age, although there are elders in the Jerusalem church in James. More examples could be demonstrated, but it is already clear that Mormonism and early Christianity have similarities and differences which are not reducible to simple formulas. It is a complex issue. The New Testament does not offer a blueprint ecclesiology. It does not offer a Jesus who gives instructions about the church and its future. This realization raises questions concerning assertions by some Latter-day Saints that the Restoration was a rediscovery of a master blueprint. For example, Orson Pratt wrote, quote, "So far as the officers are evidenced, both ancient and modern saints are exactly alike," end quote. The sixth article of faith reads, "We believe in the same organization that existed in the primitive church, apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers, evangelists, etc." But this raises questions. Which organization in primitive Christianity? At what time period? Which officers? Did an organization even exist? It is obvious that these LDS authors, including Joseph Smith, saw a pure form of Christianity existing at a specific time and place, which could be pointed out without much difficulty. As we have seen, however, it is virtually impossible to point at a time and a place in pre-100 AD Christianity and say, this is the period of perfection, if the standard of measurement is Mormonism. You can't find a real close parallel to Mormonism in any one period and place. If Jerusalem in the 40s is chosen as being where the true church existed, because the 12 had most power there, what about the bishops and presbyters who didn't exist until 5 decades later? If, as is sometimes heard, the Hellenization of Christianity began the apostasy, then should the high Christology of the Johannine community, which most Christians, including Mormons, have accepted, be considered apostate? From this, it appears that Mormonism accepted some elements, structures, doctrines, etc., from all periods and places in primitive Christianity, and rejected elements in all places and periods in Christianity. they didn't just get it from one supposedly perfect age. The Christianity of Jerusalem in the 30s was just as important to Mormonism's restoration as the Christianity found in Antioch in the 70s. Okay. This is going to lead to some final comments. Okay. Now, why did early Mormonism view Christianity as a period of perfection? Mormons accepted what Robert L. Wilkin has called the myth of Christian beginnings, a myth which began within a century of Jesus' lifetime and dominated a Christian self-understanding for centuries. Norman Perrin has written the following about the mindset of a Christian who was living at the end of the first century. Quote, "The church is now separated from the age of the apostles by a considerable period, and the tendency is to look back on that time as one of perfection, as the time of revelation by God to the church in the persons of the apostles." End quote. This interpretation of early Christianity recurred throughout history and found a home in the primitive gospel movement of 19th century America in general and the Seeker movement in particular. And these ideas undoubtedly influenced early Mormons, including Joseph Smith. If biblical scholars are correct about Jesus' attitude towards priesthood and a church, then the primary cause of the differences between early Christianity and Mormonism lie in their respective founders. Both Jesus and Joseph Smith saw their movements as constituting a restoration of ancient Israel. And that's very important to note, because if structures and things are different, still the main goal is pretty much the same, that it's a restoration of ancient Israel, as Jan Shipps has pointed out. However, Jesus and Joseph Smith's concept of priesthood was different. Mario Estepias has pointed out how common the search for the one true religion was in Joseph Smith's day, and how well the prophet and his message responded to this desire. Compared to other groups, Estepias noted, quote, "how much more elaborate and theologically central was the Mormon concern for authoritative religion," end quote. For Latter-day Saints, DePia says, only the restored priesthood could save a torn and divided Christianity. Jesus, however, saw no need to replace the Jewish temple priesthood. In the eschatological restoration, God would replace the temple, not the priesthood. But this is assuming that Jesus didn't implicitly establish a rival priesthood. Thus, priesthood authority was more of a formal concern for Joseph Smith, and this is the cause of many dissimilarities between the movements. This leads to the final question. If the concepts of priesthood and the ecclesiastical structures are different in Mormonism and primitive Christianity, then what exactly was restored? If an oversimplified view of history is held, such as Orson Pratt's, then very little was restored. If, however, a nuanced view of ecclesiology is adopted, as many Roman Catholics have done, then the restoration claim can retain validity for the believer. What does this mean? It would mean a new understanding of the traditional explanations of authority, ecclesiology, and apostasy. Yes, it could be affirmed, Jesus intended a continuation of the partaking of the sacrament. Do this in commemoration of me. Led by the Spirit, Christians gradually came to understand that this required a special priesthood authority. In this manner, Jesus established a priesthood. It's clear that this development took place in the New Testament. The question is whether this was just an accident of history or whether God led this through the Spirit, as the book of Acts and the Catholic Church claim. If you hold to the latter view, that the Spirit was guiding these developments, then you can look back into the life of Jesus and see this Last Supper as an implicit beginning of a priesthood. There's really no evidence concretely for or against that notion. It could also be said that Jesus, albeit indirectly, established a church as his disciples, led by the Spirit, formed a community that eventually became separate from Judaism. The LDS acceptance of such implicit behavior on the part of Jesus would be easier to accept if it was recognized that while on earth, Jesus was more human than the Gospel of John shows, and he may have had limited knowledge of the future, as the Gospel of Mark clearly shows. In this view, only upon his resurrection by God did Jesus attain complete knowledge of the future. So, what I'm saying basically, I think, is within the canon of the New Testament. Okay. Yes, it could be stated an apostasy did take place, but this raises the question of what kind of apostasy. Was it a spiritual apostasy, that there was people became corrupt and they lost the spirit? This was the view which the Book of Mormon and early Mormons held until around the year 1833. Or was it a loss of lineal legal priesthood authority, which is one of the emphases in the current understanding of the apostasy? To say that it was the latter raises problems historically, for the New Testament contains trajectories which led directly into early Catholicism. We've also seen that the uncertain nature of early concepts of authority make it virtually impossible to say how, where, and when the priesthood was misused or ignored and was therefore lost. Thus, an emphasis upon spiritual corruption may be more responsible historically, but this also raises some problems. What happens when you come across figures like St. Francis, who seem to be spiritually in tune? Did they receive authority? If so, did they receive it like Alma did in the Book of Mormon, in a metaphysical sense of a calling? How important is the laying on of hands for authority? Or did the apostasy take place because the plan of salvation became lost? These questions can't be answered here, but anyone searching for a nuanced view of the apostasy must keep one thing in mind. Only a few things needed to go wrong for it to occur. Finally, it could be affirmed, a restoration has taken place and still is. What was only implicit in the actions of Jesus concerning authority and ecclesiology have been explicitly revealed today. For the emphasis given to God's purpose changes with each dispensation. Whereas God once sought to renew Israel through Jesus, his message of the kingdom of God, and the cross, God today promises to renew Israel through these things and also through the restoration of all things. This includes Israelite and Christian aspects, as well as things which have been kept hid from before the foundation of the world. That's in the Doctrine and Covenants 1:24. With such a wealth of religious truths and images, it shouldn't be surprising that Mormonism is not just another church like Alexander Campbell's, basing itself upon the primitive New Testament gospel. With a nuanced scholarly view of the scriptures, then, it can be affirmed that Mormonism is a restoration of early Christianity, but also much more. Of course, the non-believer's position would not likely be changed by a nuanced line of reasoning, since it is, as in Catholicism, based upon a statement of faith which is not supported or refuted by biblical criticism. If critical methodologies, as I've used here, do not prove the church as well as the proof tech methods that our missionary discussions used, they do have the benefit of perhaps being more honest. Finally, I should say that my paper has been really specific as to what I'm talking about, and I haven't talked about a discussion of similarities between Mormonism and early Christianity in other areas, such as missionary work, millennialism, prophetic traditions, concepts of revelation, and above all, the local meetings of congregations. Thank you.
I'm sure that you'll agree with me that this is a timely topic. I applaud Rich's interests that led to it, and as well as his efforts in putting a paper together. Addressing the origins of priesthood authority within primitive Christianity and comparing them to early Mormonism is an ambitious goal, and one that certainly merits further study. There are here, however, some problems that stand in the way of this goal and in the way of some of the conclusions, and I will therefore address what I consider to be some of these. Now, keep in mind that Rich is someone who is more of a generalist. He does research on Martin Luther King and biblical things, and I'm just sort of pigeonholed in ancient things. And so that's my perspective, my point of view. I'm going to talk more as an ancient historian would and not just more as a general scholar. Ideally, a critique like this is a necessary step in the learning process, and it is to be expected in the academic community. Now, I want to stress that several of the observations that I have of this paper, I also have of other Mormon scholarship. I make these suggestions, therefore, not just here specifically, but also in hope of general improvement. I would like to see Mormon scholarship, which already has a few fine feathers in its cap, become more rich in quantity, quality, and diversity. There are 9 points that I wish to discuss here in a random order, and some of them I feel are very important, and some of them I think are sort of anal retentive, but I want to mention them all anyway. First, it's important to understand that biblical scholarship is not what manna in the wilderness was to the children of Israel. It's not wonderful. It's not incredible. What it is it's a tool, and it's a very good tool. Biblical scholarship, which we lovingly referred to in graduate school as BS, began developing during the last century by German scholars. One man in particular named Wellhausen, and he began noticing that there were different traditions or different sources in the Pentateuch. And from his scholarship and from his observations, then this new field of biblical criticism really developed. Some of the subspecialties within this field are source criticism, historical criticism, textual criticism. And from the names of these, you can see that mainly what they're doing is looking at the biblical text in a critical way. That's the new thing. Prior to that time, people would look at the text through the eyes of their faith or through the eyes of their doctrine. But for the first time, these people were looking at them just for what the text had to say for themselves. And they were coupling that with knowledge that they were getting from a new field that was just beginning, and that was the field of archaeology. Now, of course, biblical scholarship has spread not just from the Pentateuch but to all areas of biblical study. And because of this, the results are radically different than they were before. Things that people now know about the Bible and think about the Bible really in the last 50 years or even 20 years is radically different from anything that anyone thought of it before. Now, this has really produced a lot of trauma for a lot of people, especially religious leaders and throughout religious communities. And in fact, biblical scholarship is one of the main reasons that the fundamentalist Protestant groups have arisen during this century. They're trying to counteract these satanic forces that are coming out of scholarship. The first phase of biblical scholarship, then, was really one that produced rifts between the communities of scholarship and religion. But now I think we're into a second phase, which is more healthy, and that is where scholars are recognizing, as Rich has pointed out, that a nuanced view or that your faith can place in your determination of history. And also religious leaders are admitting that scholarship has a place in their world as well. So I think that biblical scholarship is crucial to our understanding, but it is by no means the last word. It is not a snapshot, but a process. And the conclusions of today will likely give way to tomorrow's as more clues about the past are uncovered, more texts are discovered, and more scholars study. As we have seen, the last 20 years or so has revolutionized New Testament scholarship, and the next decade or so promises to keep at the same pace. In other words, something might turn up tomorrow that totally changes New Testament scholars' outlook of this claim of implicit, or certainly not explicit, authority for founding a church in the New Testament. Now, I think this is really exciting that we've got this tool, biblical scholarship, now to help us know things that we couldn't possibly have known before. But I think it also serves warning to us. Now, many Mormons, and I will admit that I'm stereotyping in a big way here, have a tendency to swallow up anything that's stated by an authority. If something is written in a book, it must be right, you know. Now, we must be careful to curb these natural tendencies and practice a little healthy skepticism, both towards the secular sources and towards our sacred sources. Okay, then, not only then does biblical scholarship not reveal snapshots or really give us a tight feel for the past, but it isn't even monolithic. There are almost as many theses and hypotheses as there are scholars. There are also different schools or camps which scholars of more similar opinion congregate. This makes sense when we realize that there is no surefire way to prove or disprove most theories owing to the dearth of evidence, so they tend to pile up, sort of like nerve gas at Dugway, and nobody really knows what to do with them. Some are more popular than others, but they're just sort of out there. Which ones, then, are we supposed to believe? All we can do, really, is become as well-informed as possible and then make our own decisions. Okay, then, so my first point is biblical scholarship is a tool. It's not a revelation. Number two, this paper relies heavily upon a few New Testament scholars, and in particularly Raymond E. Brown. Now, I have nothing against his scholarship. In fact, I respect him. He and several other Catholic scholar priests, including Roland DeVoe, who is an Old Testament scholar, who is absolutely my favorite Old Testament scholar. These Catholics form a camp, which for this occasion I have named the Believing Catholic, who is also a very good scholar, camp. Now, this camp should really be a gold mine for us as Mormons, because these scholars show us that it is possible to think, to believe, and to thrive academically all at the same time. As Rich has implied, that Raymond Brown says that his belief, his faith, is an integral part of his historical research. Now, that is a very valid point for us, and I think one that we should pick up on and use as we do more research and try to develop methodologies for us to examine the past in light of our own beliefs. Brown's views permeate the paper to such an extent that I wonder if it might not have been more appropriate if the paper had not been titled Brown's Catholic Centrist Nuanced View of Authority and Ecclesiology in Primitive Christianity and Mormonism. Even when Brown is not quoted, explanations of primitive Christianity and early Mormonism take on a distinctive non-Mormon flavor. Not that there's really anything wrong with that, but it makes it obvious to me that a heavy reliance on one scholar, especially if he is not of your wants, is not totally good. There are going to be some drawbacks in that as well. Three, it's too bad but not surprising that the paper relies entirely on secondary literature or this modern biblical scholarship. This happens very frequently among Mormon scholars, where authors seem very well versed in the monographs but do not have a feel for the primary texts, which in this case would include the New Testament, the Church Fathers, the Apologists, some Roman historians. The Christian Church early on had some historians, to name a few. And these are fascinating. They're incredibly fascinating sources. The Church Fathers, for instance, surveyed Christianity really early on in light of the other systems of thought that they knew about, notably the Stoic and the Platonic philosophies. Clement of Alexandria and one of my personal favorites, the self-castrated Origen, were the pioneers of this group. The Apologists came along a little bit later, and they belong to the period when the Christian converts were first being made among the educated groups of people. And few of them were really theologians, but they were men who wanted to show both the Roman emperors and the general public that Christianity really meant something, that it had been popularly defamed and misunderstood, but that it was both harmless to the state and ethically superior to pagan codes. Some of the more known apologists would include Justin the Martyr and the fiery African Tertullian. For no other ancient religions do we have such a wealth of primary information. The early Christians wrote about themselves more than anyone else did, and so there is a good body of primary sources that we can turn to and should turn to if we're going to study this time frame. I think it would have been pertinent. Oh, and I do want to mention at this time that if not all of these sources, then by far the majority of them have been translated into English. So there really isn't an excuse for not turning to them. It would have been pertinent, since virtually all modern scholars claim or reject any claim to explicit church organization by Jesus, to discuss certain New Testament statements that seem to support that very fact. Can you think of statements in the New Testament that seem to say that there was an explicit authority, such as, upon this rock I will build my church, or I have chosen you and ordained you, or no one puts new wine in old bottles, or go therefore and teach all nations, as well as the previously mentioned, do this in remembrance of me. Okay, it would, I think, be interesting for all of us to know, since these statements are in the New Testament, but the scholars reject them, why? It wouldn't really take that much effort to explain that the teachings of Jesus, which at first were preserved by oral tradition, and then later was written down, probably in Aramaic, maybe as early as the middle of the first century, and then later on was expanded in Greek by the authors of the Gospels. It seems that New Testament scholars try to separate out these sources when they're doing their research. And any statements that are not corroborated in other accounts in the Gospels are usually suspect as being added later to retroactively authorize something, for instance. And so I would like to know if these statements are deemed to be later sources, or why don't the scholars really consider them? This was attempted briefly in a footnote, and it should be part of the text. Now, granted, it's much easier to read secondary literature, and it takes much less time than it does to try to learn Greek and Latin, or try to figure out what the primary sources even are, or to try to decipher Origen or Tertullian, or to make friends with the New Testament. But until we have at least a passing familiarity with the primary sources, we are held hostage by other scholars. Number four, speaking of footnotes, which we're not, really, it's too bad that you in the audience didn't have a copy of Rich's footnotes, because they often made the best reading. In fact, I think they are really what hold the paper together and are really the meat of the paper. And I think if they were incorporated into the text, the paper would be more honest and even more daring, and because some of the best and the most original ideas are found there. Five. It is always important to keep one's audience in mind. This is a personal soapbox of mine, so you can disregard it if you want. I talked to several people before the symposium who, when I told them which paper I was commenting on, they uniformly asked, "What's ecclesiology?" Now, when I told them that it had to do with the structure of authority or priesthood hierarchy, then they were much more interested in the paper than they were before. Now, in the introduction of the paper, we're told that this paper will assume that the audience is more familiar with Mormonism than with the scholarly view of early Christianity. But then we are barraged with a specialized terminology that a Mormon audience is likely not to be familiar with. Therefore, such words as parousia, exegetical, eschatology, Christology, and you did explain them more while you were presenting the paper this time, are not, they should be defined the first time they're used. And that way we don't have to all play the game that, well, I really should know what this word means, but I really don't, so I'll play like I do, thing that we usually do when we listen to papers. Number six, when we want to prove something with an ancient text, we must be careful not to argue from silence. Now, by that I mean that if there's no early source explicitly stating that Jesus founded a church, then what we know for sure is that we don't have a source. We don't know that he didn't found the church. Okay? What we do know, well, anyway, never mind. You see what I'm saying? In some of my archaeological research in Greece, this point makes itself so clear to me. If we relied just on the written text that we have about Greek religion, we wouldn't know very much about it at all. The very important things that we know about Greek religion come from the archaeology. It seems that the writers just assumed that everybody knew these things, and so they didn't ever bother to write them down. This is one point where I differ with Raymond Brown when he says that a nuanced view means that if you don't have an explicit statement, then your faith can lead you to say, well, I believe that that existed, and you can't prove that it didn't. Okay, but what I'm saying, which is a little bit different than that, is that if you do not have an explicit statement, there's a very strong possibility that maybe someday one will turn up, or there was one at one time and it's lost. So you don't have to rely on faith. You're still within the grounds of reason if you say, well, I have reason to think that this did occur. And therefore, you're really not relying on your faith yet, and you're still really within the bounds of reason. That might seem like a picky point, but I think it's important. Anyway, because of time, I will skip most of these. And in closing, I just want to say that too many facts here are set out about primitive Christianity that we are supposed to accept, presumably because the modern scholars think them. Many times in the paper, a statement is made, then is supported by a quote from a modern scholar. Now, in my opinion, this comes dangerously close to proof texting with the secondary literature. We are not convinced by gentle persuasion or by a tight argument to accept the author's point of view, but are merely expected to accept them. Rich is right when he tells us that it is difficult to reconstruct years of history from only a handful of sources, and that the conclusions reached thereby are tentative and disputable. But he also tells us that one's own faith is the deciding factor on how one views the past, setting up a chance for a uniquely Mormon view of these things. And then we get nothing really from Mormonism except a few quotes from Joseph Smith and Orson Pratt that show us that they were not modern biblical scholars. Surely our own Mormon theology has more to say on this topic than this. Thank you.